Thank you for staying with KHSU. I'm Wendy Butler. It's Tuesday, July 12th, and it's time for Art Waves. Two interviews for you today. Later in the program, an interview with directors involved with this year's Plays in the Park, which will enliven Arcata's Redwood Park every weekend, beginning this Friday, July 15th, into the second weekend of September. First today, California Poet Laureate Dana Gioia. He's an internationally acclaimed award-winning poet. He was chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts from 2003 to 2009, and during that time, launched several nationwide programs expanding public support of the arts and arts education. Among the critical accolades he has received for his work are for his essay, Can Poetry Matter?, which led to national discussion of the role of poetry in American public culture. He was also awarded the Presidential Citizens Medal in 2008 for his public service in support of the arts. The governor appoints the poet laureate, and over the course of a 2-year term, that individual will provide public readings in urban and rural locations across the state and will undertake a significant cultural project. Dana Gioia will be on the North Coast for 2 poetry reading and conversation events beginning next Monday, July 18th at 7 p.m. at the Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Eureka, where he'll be joined by James McCubbery of Eureka High School, who is Poetry Out Loud champion for Humboldt County. Dana will also travel to Del Norte County, where he'll be at the Del Norte County Library in Crescent City on Tuesday, July 19th at 7 p.m. Dana Gioia joins me by phone from his home in Sonoma County.
As poet laureate, I thought I would choose a kind of, you could say wildly ambitious or very realistic project, which is that I wanted to go to visit every county in California. And what I'm trying to do is, in each case, create an event that has something local as part of it. And so in most places, I'm getting the high school student who won the county championship for Poetry Out Loud, which is a national poetry recitation contest. And, these kids are terrific. And I heard them all perform in Sacramento at the state finals. And so this gives them another chance to strut their stuff.
During your time as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, you founded Poetry Out Loud. You created it. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was in Washington, one of the most important things I wanted to do was to see if we could enlarge, rehabilitate, you can choose the verb you want, arts education in schools. Because in public schools especially, so much of the arts education has just vanished over the years. You know, when I was young, which was a long time ago, there really wasn't a school so poor it didn't have a band, it didn't have a chorus, it didn't have a theater program, a newspaper, you know, maybe art classes and things like that. And now we've lost a lot of them. So, you know, we tried to do a number of things. And what Poetry Out Loud was to create essentially a program that's both a literary program and to a certain degree a performing arts program. Make it something they could sort of begin in class, but would, you know, go beyond the classroom. And it's been extremely successful. We've had about 250,000 kids. I guess it's not we anymore because I'm not at the National Endowment for the Arts, but I'm still involved with it on the state level. You know, we have about 250,000 kids participating every year, and we've had over 3 million high school students participate, you know, over the last, you know, 10 years in the program. So it's been a big step in the right direction. Not enough, but still a step in the right direction.
One of the things that is part of Poetry Out Loud is that students, they memorize, say, classic poems or poems written by others. In other words, it's not a contest for original poetry.
Exactly.
And so I wanted to know why that is, why that's part of it.
Well, there's any number of things one could do, but what we were trying to get back to was, you know, it for thousands of years, for as long as anybody's been able to track, poetry's been part of education. And there's all kinds of good reasons for that, most of which have been forgotten. And we felt that a really formative experience is to memorize and recite great language. It has a couple of effects, I think. I mean, first of all, if you're memorizing and reciting, you know, great poems, it's a literary education. It's also, I think, an infusion of great language and great ideas. And thirdly, it's a very practical skill. It teaches you how to stand in front of a crowd and speak in a way that's clear, moving, effective. And that's an extremely important life skill that, and I say this as somebody who's begun teaching, you know, in the last 6 years, most students today don't have. They mumble, they're very unsure of themselves in public. And so we felt it was it did all of the things that arts education should do. Grows the imagination, brings you into close contact with an art, and teaches you a life skill.
How do you engage people in poetry, especially for those who haven't really been exposed to it or might have a notion about it that is just not full?
Well, a lot of people assume they don't like poetry.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they don't like poetry is that perhaps once or perhaps many times they've encountered a bad poem, you know. And, you know, my experience is that and it's really surprising, I don't think this is an overstatement, almost everyone likes poetry if they hear a good poem well presented. You know, and I think that, you know, what's happened is that the way poetry has been taught in schools is so intellectual, is so analytical, is so divorced from the pleasure principle that, you know, we've turned off probably two generations of readers. I find that, I hate to say this, but I virtually never find an audience that, you know, when you start presenting it well, that doesn't like it. It's full of people surprised that they do. I've had hundreds of people, especially men, especially older men, come up and say, well, you know, I've never been to poetry reading before, didn't like this stuff, but this is really good. So I think it's really a matter that we've lost the tack in our culture for presenting poetry in an engaging and interesting way.
I found two of your poems. I wish I'd had more time to find more of your poems. But the two that I found, one of which is titled "The Angel with the Broken Wing," and the source for this was poetry, a book or a publication titled Poetry, September 2010. When did you write this?
Well, it was about the time it was published. It was published in Poetry Magazine, which is sort of the journal of record in American poetry. It's been around for about 100 years. I wrote it, you know, probably about a year or so before it was published. This poem is spoken by a statue in a museum. It's a Mexican statue of an angel. It was carved, you know, by some anonymous folk artist during the Mexican Revolution, when the churches were looted and the Catholic Church was banned. You know, it was, you know, attacked, and that's why the wing is broken. And now it's in a museum where it is much admired. But I make the point that, you know, these sacred objects, if you go to a museum, many of the things you see were created for sacred spaces, for, you know, for ritual, and now they are being seen simply for aesthetic contemplation. And, you know, the angel, you know, is not altogether happy about this situation. The angel with the broken wing. I am the angel with the broken wing, the one large statue in this quiet room. The staff finds me too fierce, and so they shut Faith's ardor in this air-conditioned tomb. The docents praise my elegant design above the chatter of the gallery. Perhaps I am a masterpiece of sorts, the perfect emblem of futility. Mendoza carved me for a country church. His name's forgotten now, except by me. I stood beside the gilded altar where the hopeless offered God their misery. I heard their women whispering at my feet, prayers for the lost, the dying, and the dead. Their candles stretched my shadow up the wall, and I became the hunger that they fed. I broke my left wing in the revolution. Even a saint can savor irony. When troops were sent to vandalize the chapel, they hit me once, almost apologetically. For even the godless feel something in a church, a twinge of hope, fear, who knows what it is, a trembling unaccounted by their laws, an ancient memory they can't dismiss. There are so many things I must tell God. The howling of the damned can't reach so high, but I stand like a dead thing nailed to a perch, a crippled saint against a painted sky.
Dana Gioia, California, poet laureate. I'm Wendy Butler, and you're listening to Art Waves on KHSU. Are you writing right now? Are you working on new material?
I'm you know, one is always writing. I've always been a slow writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes me a long time to finish a poem, usually. And I'm, you know, I just finished a little, you know, essay yesterday, and I've got a poem that I sort of put aside, you know, for a few days that is actually an odd poem. It's I'm writing a ballad about the death of my great-grandfather. Hmm. His name was Jesus Ortiz. I'm half Italian, half Mexican. And he was killed in a barroom gunfight in a place called Lost Cabin, Wyoming. And so for years I've been wanting to write about it, and I finally just, you know, sat down and started writing. And I got about two-thirds of the poem done. But I figured it was an interesting family story to tell. But I also think it's interesting, you know, about a Mexican cowboy in the United States, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, but thank you so much for sharing that with me. And one final thing I would like you to talk about briefly, if you could, is, and you have to a certain extent, but I would like to end with this. Art's impact, I know you've talked about in the public schools. One of the things that California Arts Council, as you know, has received funding for the last several years, including even more for this current fiscal year, is Arts in Corrections. And so, I'm thinking about why is it important to acknowledge art's impact?
Well, art is mysterious, but it is also very effective. I mean, if you look at how human beings communicate with each other, there's all these different things that we have. I mean, we at one end we have numbers and science. We have, you know, very abstract concepts, you know, the kind of thing that laws are written and things like this. But at the very big center of our humanity, we have this way of expressing truths in songs, in stories, in memorable language, in images, in movement, as in dance. And what these do is it takes we communicate without having to put it into abstract ideas. And frankly, I think without putting ideology into it, I can change someone's mind who disagrees with me politically more easily through an image or through a story than through an argument. And, you know, and so art, you know, has this ability, in a sense, to communicate to us in the wholeness of our humanity. And there are many times in many people's lives, you know, when they need this kind of intervention. I mean, I think it's especially true for adolescents. They're trying to figure out who they are. They know they were children and they're part of a family, but as they become adults, they have to figure out who are they individually. And so art allows them, in a sense, to try out many possible lives, attitudes, experiences, you know, in the imagination as they prepare for reality. I think, to a certain degree, the same thing's true of people that are incarcerated. You know, the life that they had hasn't been working. That's why they're in prison. You know, I've had relatives in prison. I mean, I've seen, you know, bright, positive kids go terribly bad. You know, and so they have an opportunity, I think, you know, to reinvent themselves. But they're going to do that, I think, probably more likely, you know, through the imagination. They have to imagine a life differently from their own. For a lot of these people, especially in prisons, they don't even know how to read very well. I mean, if you look at the levels of literacy in prison, it's shocking. Only about 4% of the prison population reads at a proficiency level, which is to say, a high school junior level. So these programs where people read and write can be extraordinarily meaningful in terms of giving them some skill to practice when they get out of out of prison. So it's just a way of thinking. This is that art is one of the ways in which humanity embodies the truths about being alive, and art is actually more universal in its ability to communicate than science is. I mean, science has universal applicability, but most people can't understand it. Art is more universal, I think, than ideology and conceptual language, because it talks to us as this complicated, you know, beings that have body and mind, emotions, imagination, memory, intuition, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And art does not ask us to divide those things into separate capacities, but recognizes their interconnectivity. So it speaks to us holistically because we're whole human beings.
California poet laureate Dana Gioia. Again, two events are upcoming at which you can meet him, listen to his work, and discuss it with him. On Monday, July 18th at 7 p.m., he'll be at the Emmanuel Lutheran Church, 3230 Harrison Avenue, in Eureka. He'll be joined by Humboldt County Poetry Out Loud champion James McCubbery. And on Tuesday, July 19th at 7 p.m., Dana will be at the Del Norte County Library, 190 Price Mall, Crescent City. I'm Wendy Butler, and this is Art Waves on KHSU. Plays in the Park will begin its summer run at Redwood Park in Arcata this Friday, July 15th at 7 p.m., with the first of three different plays that it will offer. For the next three Friday and Saturday nights, on stage is Georges Bizet's opera romp, Dr. Miracle. Beginning Friday, August 19th, will be The Roaring Girl. And free family Sunday matinees begin on August 21st with A Year with Frog and Toad. Our primary focus today is on Dr. Miracle. My guests are its stage director, Annika Beckstrom. Also here is Elizabeth Harrington, music director, and also a performer in the play. Finally, Megan Johnson, Plays in the Park artistic director. Annika Beckstrom begins the interview.
Dr. Miracle had its premiere 1857, and it's a one-act opera, and Bizet was really young when he wrote it. He was 18. And it is It has a wonderful combination of its base. It has commedia dell'arte. It has operetta qualities. It has some parody of grand opera. It has dialogue. So in under an hour, all the performers are asked to do quite a bit. They're asked to shift in between all of these genres quickly. And it's quite funny, witty, and also you have to be able to sing well. So it kind of demands a lot from the performers.
Is there a story going through it?
There is a story. It's a four-character story. I guess I don't want to give away the whole thing, but it's intrigue. It's about love. We have the young lovers, and we'll have a very protective father, and we'll have his wife.
And these performers are speaking some of the lines?
Yes.
As launching into different songs.
Exactly.
But it's not a musical.
It's not a musical. What? So that's where, you know, the word operetta is kind of, or opera comique here, and operetta, it has the tradition of having a combination of singing and spoken dialogue.
Well, how are you and Elizabeth working together on that?
I have the privilege. I have a wonderful cast to work with. So Elizabeth and I are, you know, colleagues at HSU. And so she sings the part, the stepmother / wife part. The daughter is Jessie Rawson. She's also a student at HSU. And then we have two non-students at HSU, David Powell, who sings the tenor part, and James Wright, who is the baritone.
But also, Elizabeth, you're providing the musical direction. So I guess when I asked how the two of you are working together, I meant the fact that you're directing the spoken, mm-hmm. and you're directing the play, the stage play, and Elizabeth is doing the musical direction. So I'm wondering how that works.
I think it works really well. We have done some private work. So she has done some private work just working on the music. And I have done some work together with a cast just working on characterization and just speaking. And then, you know, we come together and we combine the two.
Could I add a little something there?
Yeah, add, yes, please.
Because one of the wonderful things about working with Anika is that she is such a lovely singer and a fantastic musician as well. So there comes a point, really, in any show that you can't do more than one thing at once. So I have to be on stage, you know, moving, singing, performing. And because Anika is such a fantastic musician, again, she can also listen with a musician's ears and say, you know, we want to check the tempo here or we check the harmony. So that is the wonderful benefit of working with somebody as an opera director who is also a singer. And that doesn't always happen. Oftentimes in operas, you get somebody who just does, you know, stage direction. And so it's a great collaborative effort because we can do so many of the same kinds of things, you know, and it takes a lot of trust and a lot of conversations, a lot of patience and just trading off and, you know, giving each other space to stop and work something that might be dramatic or stop and fix a musical moment and just, you know, really, really being aware of those needs on, you know, kind of multiple levels.
And Megan, this is the second year that Plays in the Park, even though Plays in the Park is 4 years, this is the fourth year of Plays in the Park. It's the second year that opera is one of the things that's included.
Yes.
And how did that, you know, how did you go about choosing which opera piece to include and why to continue it?
Well, actually, it was Elizabeth who approached us with the idea in the first place last year, and we were excited to make it happen because it sounded like such an amazing idea, and it was so successful last year that we just had to bring it back. I mean, as far as selecting the operas, I mean, Elizabeth is an outstandingly talented person, and so we completely trust her opinion. So I think she could go more into the actual selection process than I could.
Yeah, how did that work?
Wow, great question. Well, I've known about this opera for a long time, for Dr. Miracle, and I've been waiting for an opportunity to do it. And one of the most interesting things about this space is that it's so very different than your typical setup for performing an opera, which can be, well, it has its advantages and its challenges. The challenges are sometimes, you know, because we're outside in a public space, we are sort of at the mercy of, you know, people walking by, you know, people are in the park enjoying it. But that also adds to the charm. And, you know, to back up just a little bit, when this idea first sort of came out, it was the fall of 2014, and we were just, Calder and Megan and I and many other people had just finished a wonderful production at NCRT of Les Miserables, and we just wanted another way to work together. And Les Miserables is, in fact, more like an opera than so many musicals, mm-hmm. because it is mm-hmm. continuous music for almost 3 hours, and there really is no dialogue. And so just, you know, the way it's put together is operatic. And so we started having conversations about, wow, how could we do more things? And then the idea of having just opera in the park setting, you know, beautiful outdoors with the redwood trees just seemed like such a charming combination. So that's how it started.
And another tradition that you are continuing, Megan, is the 50% male-female authors of these works?
Part of our artistic statement as Plays in a Park is to have 50% of the plays we produce written by women or minorities. And so this season, we kicked off with Eve Ensler's The Emotional Creature, so that's by a woman, and then the operas are both by men. And then later in our season, we have The Roaring Girl, who is co-written by a woman and a man, so that helps with our ratio. And then Frog and Toad is written by men. So it's either entirely written by a man or written by a woman and or help from another man. So, you know, it's a little fudged, but it's the fact that we're trying to break the expectation that, I mean, these days, the last statistic I heard was 17% of plays produced in the United States are written by women. And so the fact that we're pushing for 50% is astronomically higher than what most folks are able to do.
Megan Johnson, Artistic Director of Plays in the Park. Also here was Annika Beckstrom, Stage Director, and Elizabeth Harrington, Music Director, of the first play, which will take the stage for this year's Plays in the Park. Plays in the Park at Arcata's Redwood Park, beginning this Friday and Saturday, July 15th and 16th at 7 p.m. with Georges Bizet's opera, Dr. Miracle. Dr. Miracle will be preceded each evening by a short opera titled Angry Bird Song, composed in 2013 by Milton Granger. And then starting Friday, August 19th, Plays in the Park presents The Roaring Girl. And that will run Friday and Saturday nights at 7 p.m. through September 10th. And then the free Family Sunday Matinee, A Year with Frog and Toad, will begin on August 21st at 2 p.m., and its final show is on Sunday, September 11th. To purchase tickets, you can visit City of Arcata Recreation at cityofarcata.org, or you can get your tickets at any of these events. For more information, you can visit playsinthepark.net. Thank you for listening. Art Waves is produced for KHSU at Humboldt State University. I'm Wendy Butler, and I invite you to listen to this program every Tuesday at 1:30 p.m. or listen live or to archived broadcasts on our website at khsu.org.